Hey, welcome, friend, to the Town Hall Academy from Remarkable Results Radio, the only and original weekly single subject forum for the aftermarket perpetual student. Hey, it's Carm Capriotto, and we are working hard to share the voices, ideas, and insights that are shaping the future of the aftermarket. This episode is on multi-shop operations and especially the opportunities that will exist in light of the pandemic. You may be one who's thinking of selling or growing. My multi-shop operator team of Dwayne Myers, Doug Grills, and Greg Bunch bring excellent pointers for both the seller and the buyer to consider. And together, they own 15 shops. An abundance of great key takeaways or lessons as you listen to learn just one thing. Now here's a taste of what's to come.
No question about it. I would build a little bit on what Dwayne talked about in terms of making sure that you have great process and great discipline in the location before you think about expanding onto that second site and having it be a standalone operation that doesn't rely on you, as Greg talked about earlier, too.
Hello, friend. Carm Capriotto, the Automotive Aftermarket Podcast Guy, where we've cataloged every one of the 750-plus episodes by series and keywords. I'm honored to have you as a listener, where we strive weekly to give you relevant wisdom and insights to help you grow your business acumen every day. Hey, what's going on with your shop management system? You know, no other tool can transform your business like your shop management system. Now, please consider Shopware's leading shop management system. It's helping shops like yours generate more profit per ticket and get more efficiency from their staff. Hey, get a free demo at getshopware.com. That's getshopware.com, and find out how. Hey, for many, buying a new business is a challenge, and selling one after a lifetime of hard work can be a really tough challenge. Now, my panel has a pile of wisdom to share on growth opportunities, selling, buying, and store operations. We've compiled the key talking points from Dwayne, Greg, and Doug, and you can find them at remarkableresults.biz/A171. These key takeaways would make a great meeting agenda or tactics on your strategic plans for growth or succession. Now, by the way, there's a ton of great advice here, so I urge you to listen to the end. And if you have a time constraint, come back, listen in chunks. The Aftermarket's premier podcast is always available 7/24 on demand and on your favorite podcast listening app. And if you don't have a listening app on your smartphone, go to remarkableresults.biz/subscribe. Town Hall Academy, the single subject forum for the perpetual automotive aftermarket student. Here we're talking today about the disciplines for multi-shop operators. Let me introduce my panel, Dwayne Myers, Dynamic Automotive, Frederick, Maryland. Four locations, right, man?
Four locations.
Doug Grills is with us from AutoStream Car Care Center, multi-shop owner, Baltimore, Maryland. Six locations, right?
Yes, sir.
And Greg Bunch, Aspen Auto Clinic, Denver, five locations?
Yep, Colorado Springs and Denver.
So let me add that up. There's like 15 locations among you guys. Moguls. Okay. We've done a lot on multi-shop ownership in the past. I believe the opportunities abound. There may be some of you willing to go just pounce on something, and these guys are here to maybe put some reins on you. But however, there's no better time than maybe right now to look at an opportunity for growth, and it may wet your whistle to a point where you've got to stop for a moment and think this through. The panel is here because they're a group of hard knocks guys. I believe they've probably lost a few bucks on their way to being a multi-shop owner, and I think they want to give you some of that wisdom. They've learned it, the tough lessons, and yet, what a smart way to grow in the opportunity now that we have in COVID. So I know, you're going to talk about some COVID stuff. With Dwayne, you've got a lot of how-tos. Philosophically, Doug, you want to warn people, you know, what's the right methodology to grow. Greg, let's get this thing rolling. One time you said to me, you know, it's tough for a shop owner not to fall in love with an opportunity. It's a friend down the road.
Interesting. Back in 2015, one of our trade magazines, I'm not sure which one it was, did a study, said that 56% of small mom and pop shop owners wanted to be out by 2020. And ironically, they didn't know what was coming here in 2020. But I think the opportunities, especially for the people that were right on the edge that said, you know what, this is it, I'm done, I'm not fighting through this again. And they're making calls to guys like me and Dwayne and Doug saying, I want out. So the temptation is going to be, hey, let's just jump on every opportunity. But there's a lot that goes into making that right choice. So, you know, we talk about in our mastermind group, the concept of absorption versus an acquisition. Absorption would be, you know, it's a mom and pop shop. They're going out of, you know, their location is not something that would fit our business model, but maybe we can get the equipment, some employees, the database, the phone number, and merge it into one of our existing buildings. Or you're going to have the bigger shop, right? The one that does have a good location, good reputation, demographic, and that's going to be more of a target for an acquisition. And then there's going to be some of them that we just have to say, you know what, I love you, I'm sorry, but it's just not a good fit for me. And unfortunately, there's probably going to be a lot of those that just didn't have the infrastructure and the business to put in place to even have anything that's really sellable. And that's going to be part of the discipline for all of us, is to know when to walk away. And you know, and every situation is different. I don't have a formula for which ones to walk away from, but there's a lot to be looked at when it comes to that.
Boy, I'm a shop owner. I've you know, I'm so far in. I'm 8 or 9 years in, and I've got a great team and a great staff. And wow, there's some opportunities ahead. But Doug, I think you can't fall in love with the business. You got to fall in love with the location. Is that true?
Absolutely. Yeah. It still has always been a game of location, location, location. And whether it's pre-COVID or post-COVID, that doesn't change. So you always have to look at all of those important retail factors in terms of the location. You know, what type of visibility do you have to the street? What type of access does the location have? What are the terms and conditions associated with the location? You have to do all those. You have to do all that analysis and not sort of jump the gun thinking, well, there's great opportunity and I don't need to pay attention to those things as much as I might otherwise. Those fundamentals are always going to be in place and something that you need to be focused on. So take the time to do the homework and research the locations. And as Greg mentioned, I think there's going to be those opportunities, particularly with guys that have been in the business and been thinking about it, but this pandemic has basically pushed them across the line. Like, you know what, the writing's on the wall and now's the time for me to make a move.
Do you fall in love with a diamond in the rough, even though maybe the location is a little weak or the business isn't that strong?
Well, sometimes, I mean, the diamond in the rough idea is something where you see value that somebody else doesn't necessarily. So in my mind, there are sometimes locations where they are a diamond in the rough. And the reason is because the person that's been there operating it, maybe he's been there for 10 or 15 or 20 years. And so he comes in and he sees the same thing that he's looked at every day for the last 15 years. But when you see it, you see the potential that the location has, and you understand what that can do for your business if you bring a fresh perspective and a new energy. And that's sort of the polish that reveals the diamond that maybe that existing owner or maybe someone else doesn't see in the same way. So you have to really evaluate all those factors, and then you'll see if I bring a certain energy, a certain outlook, a certain drive to this location, I'm going to make it shine in a way that the previous owner just couldn't do it, because he's been seeing the same thing every day for the last 15 years.
Doug's background, he's a business person that got in the automotive industry. Dwayne and I were technicians that grew up and became business people in the automotive industry. So what Dwayne and I, and probably a lot of our audience, would be tempted is, as technicians, what do we want? We love project cars and we love fixing stuff, but that's not always the best business decision. And you know, that's where someone like Doug, he's not going to maybe buy some really ragtag fixer-upper, because he knows he's in, you know, the amount of elbow grease and energy and work that goes into that. And that's really something that people have to think about, that, you know, and I bought a shop that was a fixer-upper, and it's like construction. It takes twice as long and costs you twice as much to get it fixed than you think. So that's just something for all of us to think about as we approach these opportunities.
And I was just going to add one thing, you know, a diamond in the rough, our fourth store in Frederick, I knew it was going to be coming from the back of the development to the front because they were putting a brand new interchange in. But I had to wait, supposed to be a year, but it ended up being 2 years. But I knew it was going to change the whole dynamics of the flow of customers and its car count and everything. And it made a huge change. That turned into a diamond, but I knew I was going to have to sit on it for a year.
Great question to start out with. Thank you for the Q&A, everyone who's on Zoom. Are you willing to pay a premium for that diamond in the rough with a stickler old school shop owner who thinks his business is worth more than it is? It is the fabulous $1 million question.
Yes.
You know why it's, you know, it's funny, and Greg will back me up on this, Carm. It is the $1 million question, because every guy who wants to sell wants $1 million, right? That's the old joke.
We know that. Yeah.
You know, or what I've done is when someone says, hey, I want $1 million or whatever the number is, don't, you know, try not to insult them, because it is their, what they've spent their life building, but ask them, you know, all right, but help me convince the bank that it's worth that. Show me the value. And what it does is it puts it in perspective. They start to look at what they really have without them in it. And then it's not insulting, and they start bringing the number to a more realistic amount.
Oh my God. I mean, Dwayne doesn't have $1 million just laying around earning a couple of points of interest, and he doesn't want to give it to me because you said, I got to go to the banker. I got to go to my accountant. Ooh. What's that mean to me? I think I'd love to stretch this just a little bit. Just let's do a little how-to. You approach, opportunities exist right now. You find the location, as Doug says, you got to have. You knock on the door, you pick up the phone, you're friends with the individual who wants out. They may have called you. You go in there and says, well, what do you need? I need $1 million. Like Greg, before we got on, said, and just like Dwayne said, please don't show any emotion in that. That's the point, right? Show me how you came up with that number. In how many cases, Greg, 90, 95%, they're not going to be able to show you.
Right. Yeah, it's an emotional, you know, that's what I think my life's work is worth. Decision. It's very few say, well, it's because I make X amount of dollars and I multiplied it by this and I'm going to add this back and here you go. Most of those people that would come, if they've hired a business broker to sell their business, that's how the business broker gets paid to present that value and do the math. You know, and a lot of, you know, I've got a good friend that's a business broker that, you know, when he puts a package together, he will actually go to the SBA and say this, and you guys are probably, if you're looking at biz buy sell, anything like that, you're going to see that it'll say, you know, pre-authorized for SBA, meaning they've vetted the numbers. They've come up with a value, you know, they know the SBA standards of what they're willing to pay for. But 98% of what we're talking about here is not going to be the case. And, you know, just like in a lot of things, right, with hiring an employee, it's not always about how much they're going to make. It's the total package. So what we advise our clients to do is to dig deeper than I want $1 million. It's what do they really want out of it? Is it, you know, do they want paid over time? Do they want a guaranteed lease? Do they want a big check all at once? You know, how much are they willing to do any owner carry? All of those things go into a deal. It's not just, I want $1 million and here's why. If I can dig and find out why they want $1 million, well, because I want to put it in the bank and or an investment and I want to make $100,000. You know, I've got this buddy that says I can get 10% return. I want to make $100,000 a year for the rest of my life. Okay, well, that's, so if I can get you to $100,000 a year for the next X amount of years, then you're solving the same problem and you may not have to pay that much or pay that much up front. So there's a lot that goes into that. It's not just the dollar amount that they want.
Hey, Carm here. Now think about your shop management system. Isn't it the center of your business? And most of us are running on systems that are decades old, and you know who you are. It's time to change and get the benefits that a modern system can bring to your business. Shopware Shop Management is a cloud-powered management system that gives your staff and your customers the end-to-end digital experience that they expect. With Shopware, you can see every job and view work updates in real time. And you can manage your shop from anywhere with any device. And that's becoming more important than ever. You'll see your customers interact with digital work orders and buy services from you more often with less effort. You can earn more parts profit with just the click of one button and with less paper, too. You'll also get improved efficiency from your staff. Do this. Request a live tour of Shopware at shop-ware.com. Look, it's time to make the switch and get started making more money with a powerful, modern business tool designed to solve your biggest challenges. Hey, let's spend a moment, guys. Do a role reversal for me. You're not the buyer, but you're the seller. And I know, you know, listen, we repurpose these episodes. They'll sit out on the World Wide Web, you know, in perpetuity. The video will be repurposed. The reason we do this on Zoom every Friday, the intensity of live and the value that we get by publishing the podcast. So people call me up all the time or they write to me and they say, hey, do you have anything on this? Of course, all the episodes on growth and selling and or buying are all cataloged together. spend a moment, do a role reversal. So you say, a guy just called me up, I'm going to ask for $1 million. Deep down inside, is there from each of you a little bit of perspectivity that we could give to the seller?
I know in my mind, when I put a valuation on a business, like we were talking about a second ago, there's a process that you have to follow to be able to come up with something reasonable in terms of what the value of your business is. And we can debate about, you know, we understand it's an emotional issue. It's your life. If it's your life's work, like Greg talked about, but at the end of the day, you know, what are the fundamentals of the business? What is the cash flow of the business? What's a reasonable multiple for you to expect in your market? And then that number that you come up, that valuation that you come up with, as Dwayne suggested, it's got to be rooted in fundamentals. There's got to be fundamentals in the financials that justify a certain valuation. And you know, and I understand that there's emotion involved, but you have to be able to come to some agreement as to what's a reasonable value. And I think as a seller, as a buyer, there should be our ability to come to some common ground. And if it's a completely emotional decision, you know, if somebody has a position where they say, this is what I have to get or I'm not leaving, then my reaction is a little bit, well, maybe you're not really ready to sell then because you're not being realistic about the value of your business. But I would say, even from a seller's perspective, you need to start with these basic calculations, this basic understanding of what the value of the business is, and then, you know, and go from there and see if there is some premium to be commanded in the market. There may be external factors, extenuating circumstances that might drive greater value in your situation, and you can evaluate those on a case-by-case basis, make your argument, and hopefully the seller agrees with your position, and if not, you know, you'll move on to the next guy.
And if you're a seller and you want to optimize value, make sure your business can function without you. You know, the best way to actually bring value is to make sure that day-to-day operations are not you. And if you can show that, that means they're not going to lose that when you walk out the door. So that would bring the most value to me. If you can create a team to where it functions day-to-day operations and gets that EBITDA and gets the number at the bottom that you're going to evaluate it with, it could bring a premium.
Everything just is surrounded by the owner. And if the owner's not there, you know, I talked to an owner the other day that has not taken a vacation in 4 years because the business won't function without that person. And it's in a, you know, an auto mall type of thing. There's no, right? All he can do is extract the paycheck out of it. There is no resale value in what he's built. But like Dwayne said, if he had a standalone location, he had 4 or 5 technicians and a manager and advisor, and he was able to operate more as a CEO and oversee everything and still, you know, have good cash flow, that is absolutely a business that not only one of us would be interested in, but, you know, that's when you get into the, you know, you could catch the attention of a private equity or something like that and get a reasonable rate of return on buying that business.
So guys, I own a business. It's making a couple of percent net operating income. Someone approached me. I say, I want $1 million. The buyer said, no, I can't swing that. It just doesn't look like it's right. How do you justify that? Well, I haven't. 3 or 4 weeks later, the seller decides to hire a broker and says, I'm going to get a broker to really talk turkey to someone. And the broker comes back and says, $250,000. Do situations like this happen when the broker comes in and they recognize after they've torn apart the financials that the real number is the X?
Absolutely.
Okay.
And that's part of what their expertise has to be in, is having those tough conversations with business owners about how a business is valued, how a purchaser buyer is going to look at the deal. And so, yeah. And, you know, on the flip side of that coin, Carm, if somebody is going to sell, you know, there's pros and cons, and I teach this in my succession planning class that we do on this. There are pros and cons as a seller, whether you go through a business broker or you try and sell it on your own. And, you know, that's something we can get into a little bit, but the right decision could be one or the other for somebody. There's not necessarily a right answer, but, you know, traditionally, a business broker that's good and worth his chops will probably get you a little bit more money than you could on your own and some better exposure. But again, now you're paying the fees that go along with that, and the process is usually a lot longer. So, and again, you may get hit with something like, hey, I'm not even going to take this selling of your business on until you get some of these fixed and some systems and processes put in place. And some people just don't have the patience. They're like, you know what? I'd rather just fire sale it and get out than go through that process.
Hey, thanks, guys. This beginning was, I think, was important, and I think it helped set the tone. Let's go back to the title that we created here for this episode, Disciplines for Multi-Shop Owners. Dwayne, I want to go to you. One of the best process guys that I know of, and I just love you to speak to SOPs, maybe?
I don't know if we're the best, because we're actually taking this time to tighten some of ours up right now.
But that's
now.
Exactly what needs to happen. I mean, it's always a constant tweak, right?
Yeah. Well, and I'll go back to, you know, SOPs are important for replication, for scale. And where we made a mistake was, you know, we went to number two and number three without them. We had a few, but nothing like we needed. You know, once we got to four, we realized that we had, you know, we had four stores waving the dynamic flag, but we're all truly running a little different, you know, and that's not good. If you go, you know, one place and then they go to another store, you know, it should be the same experience. And we weren't having that. So we worked on that. And it's important. If you do it at the beginning, you're going to save yourself a lot of headache and heartburn. You know, and it also allows it, you know, and when I'm done, I want to have a toolkit where, you know, all right, we have our fifth store here ready. You're, you know, you've been in our training for leadership. Here's the toolkit, has all the stuff in it. Here's the keys, open the door and get started. And it boom, it turns into a dynamic automotive. It isn't what it was or what you bought. It's us. Just moved over.
McDonald's?
With a little more personality.
It's funny you said that, Carm, because instead of watching Tiger King, you need to watch The Founder. That's the story of Ray Kroc and McDonald's. Yep. And yep. I could not sit still when I watched that movie. It was a couple of years ago. Of all the business lessons that are in that movie. And again, it's not there. There's people that, you know, the morality and some of the decisions that Ray Kroc may have made in his life, it's not about that. It's about exactly what Dwayne said. You know, the McDonald's brothers were only able to build their business to a certain level, and then things started falling off the cliff. And it took somebody with Ray Kroc's vision and skills to come in and systematize things and clean it up and obviously turn it into what it is today. So, if you have an inkling about going multi-store, that's Greg's homework assignment to you is watch The Founder instead of Tiger King.
Good movie. You guys ever watch The Prophet, Marcus Lemonis?
Yes.
Did you ever yell at the screen and say, run the other way, Marcus?
Run! Absolutely.
And when you do that, you basically are putting yourself, you know, into a position that you finally get people, process, and product, and how important all of those are. I think that's one of the best, if you will, business person's show you can buy. Because if you wanted to be a really warm, fuzzy kind of owner who's really knows what tough love is, you should grow up and try to be like Marcus.
No question about it. I would build a little bit on what Dwayne talked about in terms of making sure that you have great process and great discipline in the location before you think about expanding onto that second site and having it be a standalone operation that doesn't rely on you, as Greg talked about earlier too. When you start a business, you're typically nervous, you're excited, you come in with a certain amount of brashness, and you want to make success happen right away, and you're not as focused on some of these other things that you're going to need to be able to branch out and continue that this growth that you envision for yourself, if that's what you decide you want to do at some point down the line. And having all those things written down, documented, making sure everybody understands them, understands how you guys approach the business, you're going to have to do that. And I always say this when we're together in mastermind meetings, having the discipline to write it down forces you to think through exactly what you want things to look like. That's the beauty of it. It's not so much the outcome. It's not the manual that you're going to have hand for somebody. It's that you're going to have the answer and it's clear in your mind. And now you can communicate it to people. And then as you begin to grow, as Dwayne talked about, I mean, for us, when we go into a location, we had a competitive acquisition late last year. We go in there, we know exactly what that's going to look like and exactly how we expect it to be run. And here's our process and here's what we do. And here's how we handle the phones and here's how we handle digital vehicle inspections and all the other things that we do day in and day out. There is no question about how we do it. We're ready to run in there and make that an AutoStream car care location as quickly as possible. And then how quickly you introduce your brand, there's subtleties to that. If it's going great, maybe you fly in a little bit lower under the radar. And if it's not going great, you want to shout from the mountaintops that, hey, a new sheriff is in town. So there's subtleties to that. But the reality is when you come in, you're ready to go. You're locked and loaded. You can make that happen. It's duplicatable and something that you can make happen again and again.
These guys have fallen on wonderful opportunities in their life, but not necessarily were they all beautiful and smooth and soft like warm butter. One of the things that I think all of you realized early on was cash was king. And you can't do any of this stuff. Don't fool yourself. Oh, let me see. Hard times, COVID, no money. How am I going to survive? You need that same philosophy if you're going to put money away. To see, even your banker is going to come to you and says, listen, you don't have any cash. You're going to leverage everything you got. This thing isn't really looking perfect. We don't like what the financials look like. We may not want to supply, support you. So banking and cash, guys, talk about that.
That's a great topic. And we've been talking about that quite a bit again in our groups. You know, everybody got hit pretty hard with not knowing what this was going to turn into. And so, you know, the folks that had a war chest put away were able to sleep better at night than the folks that didn't. You know, obviously these PPP loans and things that have come through have been a definite help to everybody. But it's a good wake up call to, and entrepreneurs are internal optimists, right? We think everything's going to be shiny and work out just perfectly. Well, we all just realized, well, that's not always true. And it's the same thing as you go into a deal, right? If you have your projections, but in the back of your mind, okay, what if I really don't hit this? What if I'm at 50% of what I think or what I've told the bank I can accomplish here? Can I make it financially? Do I have the war chest? Do I have the lines of credit? Do I have the relationship with the bank? Whatever that looks like. And you know, I know I'm preaching to the choir here, but you know, the old saying in business, people don't go out of business because of lack of profit. They go out of business because of lack of cash. And we can get lulled into a sense of comfort because we're a cash flow business, right? Most of us don't have a lot of accounts receivable. The money comes in, pays the bills, the money goes out. And so we're used to seeing a lot of money in the bank per se, but it doesn't mean that you can allocate that away. And I know that you've talked about it on your show, and I know we all do internally, you know, kind of the profit first concept. And really, you know, if you get down to it, it's the common sense of what we should all be doing with our business and home. And that is, you know, before you have a chance to spend it, you're squirreling that money away into a war chest or a, you know, a savings account that you really don't have much access to, kind of out of sight, out of mind. That's an important concept as you go into this. I can tell you the story, and I won't take up all the time, but you know, there was a time that I thought I was well capitalized when I opened my third store. And to find out that, you know, I drained the account before I got out of the hole. And, you know, it was one of those spruce goose hit the water and I almost didn't get back out of it. And so I know that reality. And on the flip side, if you do have millions of dollars of cash sitting around, you can get dumb with that too, right? You can overpay for something. You cannot be as tight on cash flow. So you want to have that $1 million set aside, but you don't want to think about it. You want to think lean and mean as you go into a deal.
You want to keep as much as you can and do deals.
Right, right.
Carm, I think something, you know, of course, saving money is important. We'll all agree with that. But you also need to have a financial relationship, you know, with a bank. And I definitely prefer community banks for small businesses. You know, when all this stuff started happening, I called my bank. And we have a very active relationship. You know, we stay in touch. We talk. You know, her words to me were, Dwayne, whatever you need, we have your back. And you know, we've been with them for a long time. But you know, put the lines of credit in place. You know, extend the lines of credit. Stack your deck, not just your cash. You know, get everybody else's cash in your deck too. You know, get as much as you can for the rainy day. But it's important to build that banking relationship before the world ends. You need to build it so that there's relationships, just like we do with our customers. We should do that with our vendors, and we should do it with the banks as well, because at times you need them. I mean, you know, you need to lean on them. And if you've built that relationship along the way, you know, they're going to come to bat for you a lot more than if you've been beating them the whole way. No, I want the lowest rate. I want the cheapest part. You know, if it's been a relationship where it's mutually beneficial, I think they're going to come to bat for you to help you with the extra locations and the hard times.
There's nothing you can't get if the relationship is strong.
Yeah, we are all in unanimous agreement. Having a strong banking relationship is critically important. And having it with a community bank, we agree. I mean, it's a small community bank or a regional bank, somebody that you have a bona fide relationship with. They know you, you know them. And we've got a great relationship with our banks, and we've cultivated that over years. And we've done all types of things. You know, we've helped each other through thick and thin, and we get together, we socialize, we go out to events, we go to ball games, we have dinners together. So that, you know, when Dwayne talks about it, when the time comes and all of a sudden we get pressed into a situation where we need some help, they're there for us and ready to help. And when we came into this pandemic for us, I mean, we had lines of credit with them. We got additional lines of credit that we haven't even used, but they definitely allowed us to sleep a little bit easier at night. So these key relationships that you need when you're running your business, whether it's, you know, your banker, your accountant, your attorney, these are all critical relationships that you have to cultivate over time and make sure that you have them all in place so that if you do start thinking about expanding your operation, you've got a strong, solid team of people that can help you get to where you want to go.
Back in, I think it was 2017, I taught a small going multi-store foundational class at Ratchet & Wrench. And I have a slide up there that talked about this exact situation about having multiple relationships with banks. So, and I'm an investor entrepreneur, so this isn't just owning the shops is not the only thing I do. And so I have five banks that I work with. So I have four more local banks and then one big one. And I was thinking about it as Doug was talking about it. You know, on one of the banks, I have the president's cell phone on my phone. Two of the banks, I have the vice president. And third, I have a managing partner. I mean, I was on the phone 8:30, 9 o'clock at night going through all this, making sure my paperwork was in, you know, getting everything settled. The one, and I won't, it is one of the big top five that is our fifth relationship. No call. I have nobody to call besides maybe the 1-800 number. And the only thing we use that for is a deposit account because of the shops geographically. My guys go and make the deposits and then we sweep that out. So, you know, they see millions of dollars get deposited in their account, not a peep from them. But the other four, I got a personal call from the owner, or excuse me, the president or vice president of the bank. And that's the kind of relationship you want to have. And I've, like Doug said, I've gone to baseball games and sporting events, and even though I'm not a sports guy, but it's about those relationships. So they all tease me about that, right? About hitting home runs and touchdowns and getting the sports right.
Would never do that.
Yeah.
Can't believe Brian Sump likes you.
Yeah. I learned a lot watching the Super Bowl with Brian Sump. That was very enlightening for me.
Hey, I want to take one of the questions that Alan Sims asked, and we probably need an hour to discuss
Alan's
it.
Alan's a troublemaker. You be careful.
Yeah. How do you determine a reasonable multiplier? Now, guys, we can go on for an hour about that. Could we cover that in a few minutes?
Sure. I mean, it's like we talked about before, Greg mentioned the broker. You know, the broker or other people that you deal with, there's certain comps that are out in the marketplace that you're going to look to try to determine what's reasonable. And those multiples do change as you acquire additional locations. Like if you had a multi-shop scenario, the multiplier would be different. But in a single store environment, it's usually very consistent. You know, when Greg made the point earlier about a broker, and I'm not saying you have to use a broker, but here's what the broker does bring to you. If you think of the analogy of selling your home, well, what is your real estate broker in selling your home? What do? They bring great market knowledge. They understand the comps. They understand the different aspects of your house that have value in the marketplace, right? You may have a gourmet kitchen, or maybe you have other things in your house, an ensuite master bath, you know? So in other words, they're the ones that will tell you, like, this is how value is created in the listing. And a commercial broker can do that same thing, can tell you where the value lies, and can also give you a sense of the comps and what is a fair multiple in your market. And they know the neighborhoods, like just like the real estate, you know, the residential broker knows the neighborhoods, the commercial broker knows the neighborhoods too, and knows how to accurately help you assess what the value of your business is or should be.
Do we need somebody from the industry to be a broker, or can it be just someone who sells everything?
We've used commercial brokers that handle other businesses like ours, meaning they have retail presence, they use pad sites and shopping centers, things like that. They don't necessarily have to be automotive-based guys. There are some that specialize, but they can be commercial brokers that have an understanding of the fast food industry or you know, the automotive industry, or a whole bunch of different perspective uses on either in shopping centers or on pad sites or on corners. So it doesn't have to be industry specific as far as I'm concerned.
As a buyer, I would rather, and I've looked at deals through a business broker, but I would rather have a, I would rather not have a business broker if I'm the buyer. But if I were to package my business to sell, I would probably use the broker because of the availability to buyers, especially with an organization my size. And again, depends on the savviness, the time, and everything. So, you know, going back to Alan's question, I think, you know, him and I talked the other day, and we're going to talk some more, but he's looking at an acquisition. And so the question becomes, you know, what is a fair offer? And a lot of it is depends on what you're willing to pay. But somebody's got to do the math to go, okay, if I'm going to borrow $600,000 to buy something, you know, that's a certain amount of, and I've got to pay tax at the end of the day, how much net cash is left in the bank after a month. And so a lot of deals get turned away because the multiplier is so high that you're literally going to go in the hole for 5 years until the loan's paid off before you start making money. And the big guys can do that, but us guys, you know, the smaller shops, that it just doesn't make financial sense.
Greg, when you work with someone on making an acquisition, is a pro forma on the new operation for the next 5 years like the most important thing you could do?
I wouldn't say it's the most important, but it's absolutely important.
It's up there.
If your payment on the business is $6,000 a month and you're paying Uncle Sam $3,000 a month because it's making $10,000 a month and it only leaves you $1,000 of actual cash going into the bank, right? You either got to be okay with that, or you got to know that, hey, what I'm with the systems, processes, sales, everything I'm going to put into the business is going to double the profit. And now I'm going to have $11,000 of cash flow, but you're gambling that a little bit, right? You know, we all go in with confidence, but that doesn't mean we're not going to have some roadblocks to get that profit doubled. And so all of that has to go into the equation.
This is, to me, one of those topics that we could go on and talk about because you guys are so wise. You know, Greg, Transformers Institute, and, you know, he's a multi-shop business coach, mastermind leader. And are you guys members of the team together? I believe you all are.
We are.
Son of a gun, how did that happen? I don't even know.
Yeah.
Good Lord.
I was right there at the beginning too, Carm. Greg, give me some credit.
How cool is that?
Yeah. Doug's our OG. That's what we call him. Yeah.
So, okay, here we are in COVID, and, you know, the disciplines for multi-shop operator, as I said in the early beginning of this show, man, we may want to jump on something, but how are you guys coaching? Greg, I have an opportunity. I'm calling you up. I want to join the group. Give me some advice. And oh, by the way, how may COVID come into this thing?
Right. And that is, you know, nobody has a crystal ball. And so, you know, when this really first went down, I knew that opportunities, right? Anytime there's a situation like this, whether it's 01, 08, this kind of situation, there's always going to be opportunities that come out of the woodworks that were not necessarily available there before. And so I'm looking at the immediate opportunities. And so I guess my advice to my clients is proceed with caution because there's still a lot of unknowns about what's going to happen. And I look at what some of the big private equity firms are doing, and they're in a wait and see mode right now. So they're trying to preserve their cash. They're making sure that their existing portfolios of businesses have sufficient cash flow. And so I am positive. I do think that third and fourth quarter are really going to come back strong for the automotive industry. But, you know, if the virus, right, does the 1918 thing and it comes back with a vengeance and we're all shut down again, if the cash for clunkers comes up, right, there are some other situations that could have a negative effect on this. And, you know, depending on what the deal is now, I still think that there's going to be continue to have these deals. It's not like, gosh, if I don't get something done in 30 days, I'm going to miss this big window of opportunity. I think the window is still going to be open for longer than I initially thought it would be. And so, you know, and it goes back to Doug in the beginning, talking about the due diligence, right? You know, how well has this business pivoted from pre-COVID to post-COVID, you know, workflow processes and all that. And, you know, we've had some people that not necessarily in our group, but people I've seen absolutely drop the ball on that. And it may take, you know, whatever their numbers were before, they're going to have a really hard time getting back to any kind of normal. And being from somebody that, you know, I this is probably back in 2012 or 13, but, you know, I had a fire and the shop was completely shut down for 2 months. And so I know the amount of work that we had to do to get, you know, the employees back engaged, get the customers back engaged. I mean, just the marketing alone, just to tell everybody that we're open and we're back in business and get things fired back up. It was an expensive, it just didn't open the door and all of a sudden all that business was back. So how people have handled this right now needs to be part of that due diligence moving forward and what they're willing to pay for a deal.
So many things to worry about in opening our businesses up. And as you said, not having a relapse. If cash for clunkers happens, and I hope it doesn't, why would we want to bail out one industry? Although I know it's an important big industry, but I think there should be cash for haircuts. What do you think, guys? I haven't had a haircut, I think, in 2 months now. And how about cash for wings? I mean, we could go to our local restaurant and... Anyway, I just...
Yeah, and if you can, if it's illegal to put a plug in here, Carm, I know we're live, but man, you need to get with ASA. He's doing a great job with putting some information together on what to get to your government officials in your area, you know, to oppose cash for clunkers as us independent repair shops. That's, we got to do our part to make our voices heard.
Totally agree. Now, I know we're kind of about 41 minutes in, but there's a couple of things I really want to know about, and I believe our listener does too. Who was it that said location, location, location? I think all of you said, yeah, it's absolutely right. How, if I am getting ready for my first move and I wanted to do some little private research, what would you recommend I do? My buddy's got a place, you know, in the next town. How would I do some research on location, 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 without even knowing what his numbers are? I mean, where do you go for demographics? Where do you go for income levels? What do you do?
There are services that you can buy demographic information. So you can pick out an address, a corner, Spruce and Goose, and get a demographic profile for that location. So that's publicly available and pretty easy to track down. And you can get there's a lot of great information too that you can get in terms of traffic counts on the street. So how many cars are going by? So what's the average daily traffic count? And then you're going to look at how many homes are there in the area, right? How many households in the area? What kind of all these demographic things we talk about? You know, what's the average household income? How many cars per household? And some other things that are pretty readily available that you can find to be able to put together an evaluation of how the business is doing. And then you can also through some sort of old school networking, you can find out a lot of information about businesses. If it were in the next town, I'm sure I'd be able to ask around and get some info on how things are faring at the location. You're going to be able to go online, check their Google reviews, see what kind of strength of reputation they have, how long have they been there. Maybe they're a second generation business. Maybe they've been there 10 years. So these are the types of things that you can come up with a sketch of what you think the business is doing and what it looks like for you as an opportunity.
And I mean, like Doug said, you can hire or pay for services, but you can actually Google search. You know, you can get the demographics, you know, off the last census. There's information there. But like for their fourth location, you know, we looked at the permit office, what was being built. You know, they're going to build, you know, a whole shopping center around us. Right across the street now, they're about four floors into a six-story hotel. They're putting a huge gas station with a convenience store that brings cars. You know, you can look at that stuff and see if you're willing to wait for the benefit. You at least have an idea of what's coming. Is it a dead area or is it a growing area? You don't want to me, I wouldn't buy a shop in an area that's plateaued or declining. You want one that's still going up. And that information is public knowledge. You just have to do your due diligence. You can do it on the cheap side, or you can pay someone and they can hand you a piece of paper that tells you.
Right. You know, we at Transformers, we do some of that background for our clients that, you know, we can do some demographic studies and that kind of thing, you know, what the average income and all that. But one of the gut checks to do, Carm, and I'm very fortunate because one of my best friends in the world is a very, very successful commercial realtor. He used to be an M&A executive for Bendix, for those of you that remember that company. So the gut check is, you know, we were looking at a potential acquisition that was an existing business. And he goes, would you want this building if there was not an automotive repair business already in it? And they were doing $85,000 in it. And the answer was no. And why was because it wasn't an A location and it didn't have the demographic that it was in. Now, this guy, I know him personally, he ended up selling the shop. But at the end of the day, he did a really good job extracting the people that were good customers and had the money to pay out of his neighborhood better than any other shop around. But I think he did such a good job at that. I couldn't see a lot of room to where he was going to get more than $80,000-$90,000 a month out of that store. And so it, because I literally, there was a building very close to that that I turned down 5-6 years ago because demographically it did not support our business model, which is, you know, more of a higher end master technician, probably like a lot of our listeners model. It wasn't a, you know, we're not a discount model. A discount model may have worked better in that shop, but so if you're thinking of something, right, then that needs to be part of, it's not the only answer, but would you take that building over if there was not a shop to acquire in it? And then, you know, we always have this discussion too, right, that people will drive by 10 or 12 general repair shops to find a specialty shop, whether that's a Asian specialty or a Euro shop. So, you know, when you're looking at, if you're doing an acquisition in that world, that's a different story than a general repair shop.
Thank you. One of the words that came up a little while ago that maybe some of our listeners, even not only today, but into the future, say due diligence. What the hell is that? And I know we have talked an awful lot about it here, location, the demographics, what type of team exists, you know, the tenure, the certifications, the sales of the business, and, you know, where has the business been and going to, the profit or loss of the business, the model of the business and how well it works with you. What else am I missing, guys, for good due diligence?
Well, yes, all the things that you mentioned, you should be able to review and have a chance to go through. And a bona fide seller should be willing to supply you with all that. So that's the other thing. So anybody who's not willing to share information about their business operation, that's a little bit of a red flag. I'm not saying they're going to open the doors and let you see everything there is to see about their operation. But yeah, you're going to sit down and you're going to go through their financials and you're going to look at their employees and what is the strengths and weaknesses of the staff that you're looking to acquire. And you're going to try to determine, you know, what is the financial opportunity there? And I do think that Greg mentioned it earlier that you have this, as entrepreneurs, you always think that you can do things a little bit better than the guy that's there. And I think that's fair. And that's where that diamond in the rough potential comes in. Like if you think that there's an opportunity that you can see their systems, you can see their process, you can see how they market their business. You can understand, you look at their reputation online. And so your financials, the financials that you get in the due diligence process are really dependent on all of those factors. And if you think that you can make a change in those factors, then obviously your financial picture should be more positive. And then based on that positive outlook, you think there's great potential, but you're going to pay based on what he's doing. In other words, I'm not going to pay based on what I think it can do. Somebody, I saw a chat or a question where it came up, are you willing to pay a premium? I guess the answer is maybe, but it would have to be, there'd have to be some outstanding, really attractive, extenuating circumstance to make me want to pay a premium. I'm going to pay that guy what it's worth based on what he's doing. And then obviously I go into it with the understanding that I think that I can make changes that will make it more valuable for me. And that's why I'm going to get in there and get the deal done.
Well, we can go on to a very interesting discussion on how to pay a premium for a business under what circumstances, but we're not. I just, a million things just went through my head because, you know, I did do a bunch of M&A and when I worked for corporate America. Thank you for your support always. Have a great weekend.
Thanks, Carm.
You too.
Thank you.
Thanks, Carm. Thanks for having us.
Thanks for being on board to listen and learn from the premier automotive aftermarket podcast. Until next time.